show and Mokun to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the broadside that Hillary Clinton leveled at Donald Trump in a speech in Ohio that was a follow-on from her takedown of Trump as a steward of national security. William Cohan, a former senior Wall Street investment banker and best-selling author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, who is a columnist for the Deal Book section of the New York Times, joins us to discuss today's evisceration of Trump's business record of fraud and financial malpractice that leaves creditors, employees, and service providers high and dry while Trump walks away as the only winner who profits from serial bankruptcy. We will assess whether Clinton's speech will undo the advantage that Trump has in the polls over her as a steward of the economy, which the 14 million Americans who have voted for him see as his strength and believe he will improve their lives, even though his record is disastrous and he clearly only cares about himself. Then we'll look into the effectiveness and credibility of America's Muslim leaders who appear on television after every massacre or terrorist atrocity to proclaim Islam as a religion of peace while distancing themselves from the recurring acts of terror in the name of Islam. Annie Zonneveld, the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, joins us to talk about her article at the Huffington Post, Reality Check, What American Muslim Organizations Really Did for the LGBTQI Community, and discuss the extent to which ties to Saudi Wahhabism compromise the credibility of those who decry these repeated acts of terror. Then finally, we'll examine the recent report by the UNHCR that finds last year topped the record of the number of displaced people in the world that is now greater than it was after World War II. Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, joins us to discuss the fate and future of a record 65.3 million asylum seekers, internally displaced or refugees that make up a little under 1% of the Earth's population, one half of whom come from three countries, Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. And joining us now is William Cohan, who is a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere & Company. He is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a columnist for the Deal Book section of the New York Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Always great to be here.
Thanks, Bill. And by the way, the last time we spoke, you told me that a lot of people on Wall Street aren't too thrilled with Trump because he took down a lot of banks for a lot of money, and the bankers have long memories. Hillary Clinton today, talk about reinforced that idea. She made the most blistering attack on Trump, saying, I guess the big takeaway line will be, just like Trump shouldn't have his finger on the nuclear button, he shouldn't have his hands on our economy. So given that Mitt Romney has already gone public and said Donald Trump's business model is fraud, how come he's about 47% of the American people think he'd be better on the economy and 41% think that Hillary would be better? So he's already won the economic war, so I guess she's going after his strength, right?
Well, I mean, look, I think that there's probably a fundamental failure to understand among most of the American people the way the economy works, who might be the best steward for the economy. And I think for whatever reason, 14 million Republican primary voters have convinced themselves that Donald Trump, because he is a billionaire or at least a very wealthy man who flies around in a private jet and lives in a pink marble mausoleum high above Fifth Avenue, is just the person who can supposedly solve the nation's economic problems. I'm not quite sure why these people have put so much faith into Donald Trump's financial skills, economic knowledge. He certainly has, as Hillary Clinton mentioned today, been responsible for the bankruptcy of four casino companies in Atlantic City. He has left a lot of creditors high and dry in the process, which is why Wall Street has a long memory about this and is frankly you know, very sheepish about wanting to support him, notwithstanding the fundraiser that's going to occur tomorrow on Wall Street. You know, I think that there's a fundamental disconnect between the legitimate desires of a large swath of the American people who have sort of been left out of the wealth creation that has occurred in this country since the financial crisis for a select few, who have been left out of that and for whatever reason have put a lot of faith into Donald Trump as the one who can solve that problem. But as somebody who knows Donald Trump, as someone who has written about him, as someone who has worked on Wall Street and covered Wall Street, written about Wall Street for the last 12 years, I, for the life of me, cannot figure out why there is this faith, and I find it extremely misplaced, and I think that's one of the points that Hillary Clinton was making today in her economic speech.
So then how would you categorize Donald Trump in the lexicon of American business? I mean, Hillary Clinton went out of her way to talk about her father being a small businessman and how he operated on trust, and the last thing he'd contemplate would be chiseling anybody or defrauding anybody, because in the business world that she talked about, your word is your bond, and you're only as good as your word. It's pretty clear from what we know of Donald Trump's record that his word is absolutely meaningless. He's more of a sort of huckster, salesman, you know, snake oil guy. He's great at selling, but he's only the beneficiary. You know, he promises that all of these people will get rich, but the only person who ever gets rich is him, and everybody else gets defrauded. And Hillary Clinton mentioned in many cases their lives get ruined. So in terms of the street, do they see this guy as a businessman or just as a self-serving huckster?
I mean, I think they see him as sort of the music man, Henry Hill. I think they view him as somebody who, as you said, is an extraordinarily good salesman, very good at promoting himself and his brand and all the various enterprises. I mean, if you look at his Federal Election Commission forms, I mean, there's at least something like 500 various limited liability corporations that he has set up to, you know, contain various assets that he has put together. You know, he's very good at slapping his name on tall buildings in New York without owning them, slapping his name on golf courses and other developments. He is very good at promoting himself and his brand, and he is, frankly, not considered either a serious real estate developer or a serious businessman in New York financial circles. He is not well regarded as somebody who's able to buy businesses and grow them and develop them. He has not been particularly good at buying troubled assets and turning them around. But he has been good at convincing a certain slice of the public that the Trump name stands for something and is worth having slapped onto big buildings in New York and will bring in people who want to somehow be associated with that name. And you know, as we discussed, you know, when he did own properties when he was younger, when he did start his various casino businesses in the 80s and 90s, and they went into bankruptcy, you know, he left a lot of creditors, people who had put their faith into him, to say nothing of employees, people who did work on his buildings, service people, you know, high and dry. And, You know, he chalks it up to just sort of doing what other businessmen do when they go into bankruptcy and then come out the other side. I think he said something like, you know, Walt Disney went into bankruptcy and came out the other side. You know, all of these things are true in the sense that there's no question that Chapter 11 and bankruptcy are a tried and true method of trying to reduce your debts that is, you know, widely accepted. But, you know, to go into bankruptcy four times with various companies that you're involved with, you know, and then to sort of come out the other side and to claim that you're a good businessman sort of stretches credulity. You know, Hillary Clinton made the joke today that he's written all of these books and all of them end at Chapter 11, which is a bit of a funny joke, but, it, you know, one is left with the feeling that this guy is nothing more than a huckster. And, you know, to not pay your creditors, to not pay your employees, to not pay the people who do work, your contractors who do work on your buildings, I mean, I can't imagine, again, it all gets back to my fundamental disbelief that this guy is going to actually do something for the millions of people who really deserve to have something done for them in this country, who have been left out of the economic expansion that has occurred since the financial crisis, who are obviously left out of the boom before the financial crisis, and are wondering, you know, all these people are getting rich, including Donald Trump, but they are not. Why they think a guy like Donald Trump is going to actually help them is, you know, beyond my comprehension.
Well, maybe what this is about then, William Cohan, is aspirational politics. You know, the idea that people aspire to be millionaires, and that's pretty much what Trump is promising. You know, some of the fairy dust, some of the gold is going to, you know, sort of rub off from me onto you. You still get back to the fact that the polls give him a 47% to 41% advantage in that particular question of who would be the best steward of the economy. So given that Karl Rove decided the best way to go after John Kerry was to attack his greatest strength, which was that he was a war hero. So he invented these swift boat assassins, and they had an effect. So in terms of strategy, do you think Hillary Clinton's speech is going to work, or is this just a speech and not a strategy?
Well, if it is a strategy, and I hope that it is for her, I think it's a good one. I mean, between the four bankruptcies in Atlantic City, the scam that was clearly a Trump University, his prevarications about the amount of his wealth. He claims now that he's worth $11 billion without giving any evidence whatsoever of how he arrives at that number. You know, he's a guy who will claim that his brand is worth $3 billion. I mean, so he's obviously fond of exaggerating his personal wealth. For what reason, I can't fathom. I mean, I think we could stipulate that he's plenty wealthy. Why he needs to claim to be worth $11 billion, I don't understand. But if you look at any number of his ventures, from steaks to wines to Macy's to whatever it is, basically most of them have flopped and fallen by the wayside. He's extremely litigious. He's very good at promoting himself and his own brand and saying outrageous things that get attention and lots of free airtime on national cable television, which is obviously a great skill, which we probably have not seen before and may never see again. But that's not the same as success in a business setting. That's not the same as gaining people's respect. I mean, the thing is, in New York, where Donald Trump has been, unfortunately, a household name for decades, we know that he is a scam artist. We know that he is not for real. We know that he is not someone to put your faith into. I wish that the rest of the country would understand that before it's too late. You know, and I think you can see, again, in the last few days, in the way he's running his campaign, firing his campaign manager, having virtually no money in his coffers to run a national campaign. It's just astounding, you know, why anybody would put their faith in this guy. I just find it unfathomable. Now, maybe it's because I live in New York and I don't understand what's going on in the rest of the country and how disillusioned the rest of the country is with our institutions and the way the economy is being run and the way the nation's laws are being made or not being made. But I think I do understand that. I think the palpable frustration goes across the whole country. It's not just reserved, you know, for the people in the great middle of this country who somehow have been left out. I think we all understand what's been lacking and why we find ourselves in such a difficult predicament. But what I don't understand and what I'll never understand is why people have apparently 14 million Republican primary voters have put their faith in Donald Trump as the guy who's going to solve their problems. I think that is going to end extremely badly if he gets elected president. They are going to be extremely disappointed that in what he's going to do for them or lack thereof.
Well, Hillary Clinton, in her speech today in Ohio, did mention Moody's Analytics. The report that was done recently that said that Trump would cause the loss of another 3.5 million jobs, concluding the report said the upshot of Mr. Trump's economic policy positions under almost any scenario is that the U.S. economy will be more isolated and diminished. Now, again, that's, you know, wonky stuff. I'm not sure how I share your puzzlement as to why anybody would look at the guy that the conservative talk show host in Wisconsin calls the Orange Duce, how anybody could look at this guy and take him seriously, even try to follow what he's saying, it causes brain damage. But the other thing that I think possibly might work, and it did work to some extent when Hillary Clinton demanded Bernie Sanders show some of his tax returns, he actually ended up just showing one. But Trump's hasn't shown any. And my sense is, and a lot of people's suspicions is, that they're going to show that, one, he paid no income tax, and two, he doesn't make as much money as he claims to have, and three, he doesn't give a dime to charity.
I suspect you're right on all three of those. And, you know, he would defend that by saying, you know, he's allowed to take advantage of the laws, the tax laws, that allow him to pay as little tax as possible, and he has become an expert in that. But, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it, or fine. If you want to do that, if you want to be stingy with your philanthropy when you're as wealthy as he is, if you want to go on a major tax avoidance scheme, then fine, you can do that all day long in this country. That's probably one of the things that makes this country great. But don't inflict yourself on the political system and run for president saying these incredibly inflammatory things that have no place in our politics, no place in the dignity of our country, no place in what makes this country great, and, you know, dominate news cycle after news cycle with this garbage and this gibberish, and then, you know, put yourself forth as a serious candidate for the President of the United States. It's just extraordinary, and I can only hope that he goes down to a massively flame out in November, and, you know, the Republican Party is left in tatters as a result of them nominating him. And I think that's the only way that we can recover from this experience that we're all having now.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, who's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard, Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, and The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard, Frere & Company. He is the contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a columnist for the Deal Book section of the New York Times. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the effectiveness and credibility of American Muslim leaders who appear on television after every massacre or terrorist atrocity to proclaim Islam as a religion of peace.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. All day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a bitty-bitty rich, idle-diddle-diddle-diddle man, I'd build.
We've all seen enough, now it's time to decide. The meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God damn it, things fall apart.
And joining us now in the studio is Annie Zonneveld, who's a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an op-ed at The Washington Post, Reality Check, What American Muslim Organizations Really Did for the LGBTQI Community. Welcome to Background Briefing, Annie Zonneveld.
Hi, Ian.
And your piece in The Huffington Post is pretty fierce. You pull no punches. And I imagine the Muslim establishment, or the Islamic establishment, whatever you want to call it, are Muslim. Not too happy with you, because you really go after the care, head of the care, both in L.A. and in the country, and the Islamic Society of North America, et cetera. And basically you're calling them out on the hypocrisy that after the shooting in the massacre in Orlando, they all went on television and said how much they care about the LGBTQ. I can't go through the whole list.
LGBTQ community.
Right. It's getting too much of a mouthful. So just give us the thrust of what your argument is.
Well, when I saw them on television on CNN International, I was in Geneva when this happened, and claiming to be have been standing shoulder to shoulder with the LGBTQI community, I was completely flabbergasted, floored. I could not believe my ears. The audacity to lie publicly and to make such a claim is hypocrisy at its best. And there was no way I was going to let them get away with it, given the fact that they've always stood in opposition to LGBTQI rights for over 10 years of the activism that I've been doing in this field. I needed to set the record straight. I needed the public to know the truth. And what was really interesting, even when I called them out publicly on my Facebook, I had quite a few comments basically reinforcing my reaction, and that was, I could not believe they lied so publicly. So I'm not the only one that's appalled by this lie.
So tell me about the LGBTQ, et cetera, community within Islam itself, mm-hmm. here in the United States. Apart from the fact that you list in your op-ed at the Huffington Post the many reasons why you think they're being hypocritical, because they opposed the Marriage Equality Act in California, mm-hmm. and then the ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, etc. So in terms of your connections through Muslims for Progressive Values, have you been personally contacted by LGBTQI people in Muslim community?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are part of our community. They are members of our community. And I know how traumatized they've been. So I'm not speaking out of a vacuum. I'm speaking from real experiences and hearing their stories and being the shoulder that they cry on and so on.
Well, but how different is this from, the Catholic Church with all of their hypocrisy over sexuality? How different is it? Even the Anglican Church, which is a very liberal church, has had a hard time with marriage equality and accepting gay ministers, and it's caused all kinds of rifts. And it does seem that, almost by definition, religious organizations are extremely conservative, to put it politely, on issues of sexual orientation.
Well, then that's fine, but don't claim to be supporting them. That's what I'm saying. If you don't agree with it and you want to sow hate, which they have for decades, that's fine, do it. But don't turn around and pretend you've been an ally of LGBTQ Muslims.
Well, let's turn to the bigger issue, which you just alluded to, and that is Why is the American Muslim community so conservative? Is it the influence of Wahhabi Islam, which has influenced Islam around the world? Endless petrodollars have funded all kinds of madrasas and stuff, and we know what the results have been with radicalism throughout the world. So let's get into that issue, because it's a very nervous area to get into, to my mind, because I don't, you know, you don't want to be accused of any kind of McCarthyism. But, and also on the other hand, you have to defend the outrageous, or have to push back against the outrageous stuff that Donald Trump has both said about banning Muslims and even more recently said about surveilling mosques. So, and he's okay with racial profiling. So you've got these really dark forces out there. But at the same time, I'd like to get some clarity upon why is the American Muslim community so conservative, and how much are they influenced by Saudi Wahhabism?
So there's several questions in there. Yeah. So I'll answer the easy one first. When Trump is actually advocating for profiling, that's nothing new. We've been profiled for many, many years since 9/11. And when it comes to surveillance of mosques, that's also nothing new. Take New York, the state of New York and New Jersey, they've been doing it. So they've been, the police have been sued for that by civil societies and Muslim organizations. So what Trump is advocating for is actually nothing new. He's just playing on the prejudices towards Muslims. Now, the question is, why are there prejudices against Muslim and Islam in general? And that goes to your question of Wahhabism. The Muslim organizations are conservative. They are influenced by Wahhabism. That's been sort of their seed money. Whether they receive money from external sources, Gulf states, I do not know. However, what I want to highlight is this, is that they represent a minority of American Muslims. There are statistics out which I also hyperlinked in my article, and that indicates that only a dismal percent of American Muslims identify ISNA, ICNA, CARE, and all these conservative organizations as representative of them. A dismal number. So the majority of American Muslims don't look to them as for leadership, yeah? And yet, when something happens, it's always them that supposedly represents American Muslims when they shouldn't be. They represent their Wahhabist, homophobic, misogynistic communities, and that's it. And the majority of American Muslims don't subscribe to those values.
And again, I'm speaking with Anib Zonenvel, who's a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, Reality Check, What American Muslim Organizations Really Did for the LGBTQI Community. Well, after the Orlando massacre, I mentioned in one of the interviews I was doing that much of what you're seeing on television, the very people that you're talking about, that are the face of the Islamic society, at least for the press, the INSA and CARE, etc., and INCA, the refrain that comes out of these successive massacres is wearing thin when they say Islam is a religion of peace. Nobody's arguing with the content of what they're saying, but it's just completely inadequate to the occasion. And the American people are figuring out, for better or for worse, rightly or wrongly, they're figuring out that there's a pattern here and that you can't keep dodging it. And exactly. Now you've got this demagogue, Donald Trump, jumping on the bagwagon, saying that Hillary Clinton doesn't even want to use the word, and Barack Obama doesn't want to use the word radical Islam.
Yeah.
So are they getting the message, or is it up to people like you who, you say the community itself is more in line with your values and less in line with the Wahhabi values? So
those are numbers, statistics, so I'm not making those
right.
up here.
So is that to say then that these people who speak for the Muslim community in this country are compromised in the sense that they are a part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution in terms of their ties to Saudi Arabia Wahhabism?
They are part of the problem, and it's because of their views towards homosexuality, their views towards women, the treatment of women, the inequality in their actual treatment of women. I mean, Americans are not stupid. You just walk into any mosque and you can see it visibly how women are treated and the inequality of spaces for women in mosques. So Islam is a religion of peace is a true fact, but the problem are the Muslims. And so we shouldn't be identifying these radicals as radical Islam. The correct term should be radical Muslims, because it's the Muslims who are radicalizing this theology. Or I would go further to say it's these Muslims who are bastardizing the true teachings of the Quran. You've got several of these characters like Yasser Qadhi saying that, well, my values is that of against homosexuality. Double down on this. Fine, but, you know, don't protest when people take issue with your discriminating practices. Don't take issue when people say Islam is a religion of peace, when that is not exactly what you're practicing. Don't take issue with, this Orlando Declaration where they all signed, forcing the rest of us, meaning Muslims such as myself and non-Muslims of America, to say, if you criticize American Muslims, you are Islamophobic. That's hogwash, and so there's no alternative, and so you're either for us or against us, and that's not a conversation that we should be pinned into. The conversation should be, if you are truly American and you are advocating for equality, justice for all, as an American, then why are you undermining minority groups such as the LGBT community?
Well, to go to the broader picture of Saudi Arabia itself, the country is going through a very tense period. And the latest rationale I've heard for the US's sort of blind and uncritical support of Saudi Arabia is that we have to support the new Deputy Crown Prince, King Salman's favorite, the son, the young boy king, the kid as they call him, who's running Saudi Arabia, wants to change its entire economic profile and has gotten the country into this endless quagmire in Yemen. Mm-hmm. The rationale being that we can't afford this guy's so-called reforms to fail, otherwise the place will crack up. But I still don't have, I get conflicting pictures. Like, for example, Chaz Freeman, the Dean of American Diplomacy, he was Nixon's translator in China. He's a U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, speaks both Mandarin and Arabic. Obama wanted him to be the head of the National Intelligence Council, in charge of his intelligence flow to the White House. The Israel lobby vetoed him. A wonderful man. I just had him on the other day. He's not so hard on the Saudis, at least because I think he deals with Mohammed bin Naif, the interior minister, who's not supposed to be in good health, that they do have ways that they try to convert radicals and mm-hmm. steer them back into reality. And the last option is to kill them. Mm-hmm. And the difference with our policy is we kill them first.
And ask later.
Ask later, exactly. So, but then on the other hand, you see the Frontline documentary where hidden cameras show you that the main mosque in Riyadh, the preacher is calling for the people there to kill Jews and Christians.
Yeah,
and that's your religious duty.
That's right.
Known as takfir.
Yeah, that's
so,
right. The religion of peace.
So Chaz is calling for the Islamic countries to get rid of takfir, to outlaw it. Is that a possibility? That's one question. Second mm-hmm. question is Chaz right in saying that the Saudis do have an approach that works to de-radicalize these people that join Daesh?
Well, and on the issue of takfir, this is an issue not just in Saudi Arabia. It's a global Muslim population, because they all have subscribed to this ideology of takfiring, which is excommunicating fellow Muslims, let alone Christians and Jews. This is their bastardized version of Islam. There's no such thing as takfiring in theology, in Islam, and the Quran at its roots. People converted in and out of Islam during Prophet Muhammad's time. Nobody got beheaded or punished for doing so. I mean, there's the verse in the Quran 2:256 is there's no compulsion in faith, meaning believe or not, that's between you and God, end of story. But that's not the reality in the Muslim world, including here in the United States. The number of takfiris that have come against me and other Muslims that they don't agree is abundant. It's all over Facebook and social media. So this is not a Saudi problem. It's a Saudi theology that has been exported and unfortunately is sort of like the norm in the Muslim world. So that's problem number one. You want to eradicate that, you got to we have to completely redo the way Islam is being interpreted. And Saudi is at the root of the problem in this issue.
But does that require the Muslim leaders, the Islamic leaders in this country, to get on board and to start denouncing takfir as opposed to this mealy-mouth stuff that they come up with every time there's an atrocity.
Exactly.
And try to say that this is not done in our name.
Yeah.
When the people who do it are doing it in your name.
That's right.
That ought to motivate you to want to distance yourself from these people.
Well, the other thing, too, you have to ask yourselves, and we all have to ask ourselves, what is it about this idea of a caliphate that actually appeals to a Westerner, American Muslim Westerner, or a Muslim Westerner, wherever you live? What is it about this concept of caliphate that appeals, that actually makes you want to drop everything that you have going for you and just go out there and kill people, right? And so that's the root of the problem that no one's addressing. The Muslim so-called leadership is avoiding. What is it in your teaching that propels Muslims to want to join a caliphate? Note, caliphate does not exist in the Quran. It's a completely political Islam construct after Prophet Muhammad. So this has nothing to do with the religion Islam, but this has everything to do with political Islam. And so that's another issue. It's not that just the takfiri. It's not just the homophobia that they teach Muslims at a young age to the point where they're traumatized and hate-filled that they go out and kill. It's also about this issue of this caliphate. So on the issue of this, the kid.
The kid, you mean in the Saudi Arabian,
boy kid.
Yeah.
He's created such a disaster with Yemen, and at the same time, Chase, this gentleman that you're referring to, he's basically advocating for us to be working with conservative Muslims to eradicate takfiri. Mm-hmm. But they are the problem, right? So by advocating for such a allying yourself with conservatives who actually created this theology in the first place, you're sleeping with the enemy.
Well, you're painting a pretty dismal picture.
I'm sorry.
No, you're painting a picture that suggests that there is no way out. And again, it seems to me that what we need here is a stronger stand on the part of American Muslims to disabuse Americans who are being influenced by Trump and other Islamophobes. And when you have these incidents like which happen all the time, like Orlando, when the explanations are so inadequate to come out of them, it just feeds into Trump's narrative.
Yeah,
you know, and this is what worries me. And as I say, you don't want to get into McCarthyism and sort of say, you know, who gives you your money?
But you know what? It's actually really simple, Ian. The only way to peel away Trump's appeal is just to be honest, to have an honest conversation with the American public. This is how I believe. This is what my belief is, whether you agree with it or not. And not lie. Mm-hmm. You know, lying just feeds the fire.
Well, yes, that's the problem. It feels like when you hear this double talk that people are sort of covering up for something as opposed to a full-throated denunciation. I mean, one of the things that I've been working on with Senator Bob Graham and former CIA guy Bob Baer is to try and get these 28 pages declassified. The New York Times ran a piece about the other day. And one of the things about it that's so alarming is that the two guys that flew into the Pentagon, Al-Hamzi and Al-Madir, they were in San Diego, but they first came to L.A. And they were met by Fahed Al-Thumri, who was the Saudi consul here in Los Angeles. And he was also the imam of the King Fahd Mosque. And he took these two hijackers to the King Fahd Mosque down here in Saudi Arabia, which is down here
Culver
in
City.
Culver City, which is was funded by the Saudi Arabians. And so, you know, I don't know when we're ever going to see these declassified pages, but the stuff that's been declassified so far is so alarming and such a blueprint for this connections here to Saudi Arabia. Now, at what level, we don't know. But if that's ever proven, then you're going to have a real, real problem on your hands in this country. People, you know, the worst thing that ever happened in modern history was 9/11. And the idea that our best friends have their fingerprints on it, or at least elements within the government, is pretty outrageous. But the idea that two of the guys that flew into the Pentagon were met by the Saudi consulate here in Los Angeles, and he's also was doubling as the imam of the mosque.
So
and,
the question
and took them to the mosque where they set them up down in San Diego. So what's going on here?
Well, what's going on is our government is covering it up. Yeah. Right? That's the simple question. I mean, that's the simple answer. And the question is why? And it has everything to do with trade. It has everything to do with our arms deal. It has everything to do with economics. Simple as that.
Well, just in closing then, so that we don't end on a pessimistic note, one is that we need to stand by American Muslims. We need to fight against homophobia. We need to stop Donald Trump. But we also need a little more honesty in our dialogue about, you know, how does the mainstream religion itself disassociate itself from these takfiris and these criminals that act in the name of Islam.
Yeah. I think the first step, these so-called leaders that we've seen abundantly on television lately, is for them to start really speaking against homophobia within their own communities, and for them to actually teach.
What about takfir, though? That's,
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Yeah. Because takfiring, homophobia, misogynistic teachings, this is all part of this theology of Wahhabism. And incidentally, it's really not that much different from ISIS, except the only difference is violence. So if they really want to dissociate themselves from Daesh or ISIS, they need to really cleanse the theology that they're teaching in their institutions. Cleanse.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Annie Zonneveld.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Annie Zonneveld, who's a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, Reality Check, What American Muslim Organizations Really Did for the LGBTQI Community. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the recent report by the UNHCR that finds last year topped the record of the number of displaced people in the world that is now greater than it was after World War II.
No sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Daryl Grisgraber, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daryl Grisgraber.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be here.
And Monday was World Refugee Day, and the UNHCR released a report that says that there are more displaced people now than there were after the Second World War, with almost 1% of the Earth population displaced. That is a shocking announcement. We're talking about 65.3 million people, which is larger than the population of the United Kingdom. So do you think this is a wake-up call for the planet here?
Well, I certainly hope that it is. The increase from last year was huge, close to 10%, I guess, 9% maybe. And that is that increase, that the scale of the increase is certainly larger than what we've seen in recent history as well. One of the, shall I say, good things about this report this year is I think there's a lot more recognition of considering solutions to some of the crises that are forcing displacement, and a focus on discussion of how we can help refugees more. 2015, unfortunately, was a really difficult year for the displaced generally, but I do feel like there's more and more discussion happening more seriously about how we can help people.
Well, it seems, though, that in terms of helping people, at least the focus is fairly narrow, because half of all refugees come from just three countries, Syria, Afghanistan, and Somalia. So is that to say that if you solve the problems in those countries, not that that's easy, Syria has had the longest and most destructive and hideous civil war, Afghanistan, longest war in American history, and Somalia, which is a totally failed state. But nevertheless, at least you know what half the problem is, right?
Right. But the problem there is that solving those three situations wouldn't necessarily change the situation that significantly in terms of displacement, because there'd still be a lot of people in long-term displacement who can't return home. So those people are also being counted in this tally of displaced people. So the need to protect the most vulnerable, to offer them aid, and then at the same time to be creating safe situations where they can return home, which, make no mistake, takes quite a long time, is really, we have to have both of those foci at the same time.
So in terms of the number, though, 65.3 million, there are different categories, right? There's asylum seekers, refugees, economic refugees, and people fleeing for their lives. Is there a breakdown of within those numbers?
Yeah, so about 20 million people are refugees, and about 40 million, a little bit more, are internally displaced people, which who are people fleeing very much what we would call refugee-like situations, but they remain inside their own country. I mean, sort of like if you had to flee from Maine to Texas, for example. So you'd be displaced for the same reasons that refugees are, potentially, but you'd be called internally displaced. And that's where the really huge number comes up for people, about 41 million of them. And there are 3 million asylum seekers around the world whose cases are pending and are waiting for those to happen. Within the refugee category, about 21 million, about 18.5 million of them, of the refugees and IDPs, are in sub-Saharan Africa. So that's a really huge proportion. About a third, roughly, of the refugees and IDPs are on one continent and in one region of one continent. And that's really significant.
Well, I understand that there's a flood of refugees coming out of Nigeria and going all the way up to Libya, and there's a sort of huge underground railroad across some pretty inhospitable territory, and these people must be running the gauntlet. I mean, we've had lots of reports here in Los Angeles of Guatemalan refugees and El Salvadoran refugees fleeing the violence in those countries and eventually ending up in L.A., but they go through Mexico where they're robbed and beaten. And so let's start with Africa. Are these people fleeing the chaos of Boko Haram, or are they fleeing the corruption and the lack of economic opportunity? And what are the statistics on that, if there are any?
Sure. Well, when we talk about refugees, we're talking about people who are fleeing persecution or, in many cases, generalized violence. So we're not talking about economic refugees and people who are migrating in order to, say, find a better job or maybe to be a student in another country for several years. We're talking about people who are vulnerable and need protection. And so in places like sub-Saharan Africa, yes, they would be fleeing groups like Boko Haram or perhaps right now in Zimbabwe, of course, there's some violence going on along with famine, pre-famine conditions that are causing people to move as well. So it's people who need protection, not necessarily who are looking for something better. And these are the bulk of people that we're talking about in this report.
So is that to say then, Daryl, that in addition that you could have a larger number in addition to the 6.53 million if you include displaced people looking for a better life somewhere else?
Yeah, almost certainly. And this is an important thing that's come up in the past probably 10 to 12 years, is what we're calling mixed migration flows. So often if you see a whole bunch of people migrating, say, from Nigeria up to Libya and trying to get across the Mediterranean to Europe, many of them will be asylum seekers, many of them will be refugees, many of them will have previously been internally displaced. Some of them certainly are probably economic migrants. But this is exactly why it's so important to pay attention to these flows and to listen to everyone's individual claims in situation, because it can be very difficult sometimes to determine who's a refugee and who's an economic migrant. And even people who are fleeing for economic reasons might in fact also have refugee claims and protection needs. And this is exactly why we have to pay such careful attention to each individual situation.
Well, in terms of the people in fleeing maybe Boko Haram or corruption or whatever from Nigeria and having to make that trek all the way up to Libya, and which is in a state of civil war. I mean, the port of Sirte, which is controlled by Daesh, the Islamic State, there's a huge battle going on to, you know, to remove Daesh from that port. So it's just extraordinary to think that people can make that journey, survive
it
that.
Really,
and then get to the Libya, which is in a state of civil war, and then get on these rickety boats stuffed to the gills that often capsize in the Mediterranean. It's just a tale of horror all the way through.
It really is. It's mind-boggling. And, you know, I'm guessing a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the situation in the Mediterranean, particularly involving the route from Turkey to Greece over the past couple of years. There has been some lessening of the migration, the people participating in that route. But the fact is that every time a route sort of slows down, shall we say, others pick up to take up the slack, because people who are desperate and in danger are not going to stop migrating. And so this is exactly how we end up with, for example, people going to Libya to get on a boat to Europe, because in fact that is a better option than where they are. We've been hearing stories of Syrians who have actually gone through North Africa and into Western Africa in order to get back around to the northern coast of Africa and try to get to Europe as well. People are showing up from all over the world, are showing up in Southeast Asia, because these migration routes exist because it's where people either, one, can go, they can get visas, they can travel there in a legal basis, or number two, this is where smugglers see an opportunity to take a lot of people on board boats or put them in trucks, what have you, and get them to where they're going. So these routes are going to keep being, unfortunately, quite vibrant unless we start looking for ways to help people more effectively.
Well, the most depressing aspect of all this, though, is the number of unaccompanied children we're talking about. It's 98,400 asylum applications were filed to the UNHCR by unaccompanied or separated children, apparently mainly from Afghanistan, Eritrea, Syria, and Somalia. But that's a horrible thought, isn't it? 100,000 kids on their own making these hazardous journeys?
Yeah, it is. And unfortunately, in terms of the larger number of 65.3 million displaced people, there are estimates that up to half of those may be children as well. And refugee displaced populations traditionally tend to skew more towards women and children, because they are the ones who are more vulnerable and who are forced out by difficult situations. The challenge, of course, is that with these children who are displaced, number one, finding them safe situations, especially if they've been separated from their families, and number two, getting them educated in addition to the regular protection needs, because otherwise we're talking about, you know, millions of children every year who are losing out on the ability to move forward and live a normal life.
So what then is the solution here? Are the, if these countries that don't have the resources to handle these problems are the ones that are stuck with them, what is the role of the, you know, we know that Germany has been fairly generous in its acceptance of refugees from Afghanistan and Syria that flowed into Europe, particularly a year ago in large numbers. Other countries, I mean, for example, there's a referendum going on in the United Kingdom on they're voting on Thursday, and those that want to leave the EU are scapegoating immigrants and saying that they're, you know, we're going to be flooded with immigrants, none of which is true, but the fear of it is there. So it seems like the countries that could actually do more are scapegoating refugees, and the countries that are shouldering most of the responsibilities, some can ill afford to do so.
Yeah, unfortunately, that description does seem to be true of the situation of countries hosting refugees. But there are a number of things that can be done more collaboratively, you know, globally between nations to help this situation. I mean, number one, development aid happens all over the world, and there has to be a focus on alleviating the circumstances that cause people to flee in the first place. So, for example, countries with very high poverty rates or very low literacy rates, places like this, they're often more subject to conflict, and that forces displacement for people. So development projects in much of the developing world are considered a good first step toward helping ease displacement. The second thing is that for countries who have the resources, funding the humanitarian appeals for helping people, the United Nations, for example, funding their responses in particular countries, and using that money as efficiently as possible will also go a long way toward toward alleviating the situation. There was recently, at the end of May, there was a World Humanitarian Summit, as it was called, in Istanbul. A lot of donor nations and policymakers and humanitarian practitioners got together to talk about how to overhaul the humanitarian response system, basically. One of the very interesting things that came up there is creating more support for local humanitarian aid organizations, so that this would be, rather than an international NGO dropping into a developing country and saying, here, we're going to give out food parcels, build the capacity of local organizations in that country to help displaced people and provide humanitarian response themselves. That way you're providing the response and building the economics and the employment situation in that country. So it's something that's really going to require a lot of collaborative work around the world, and it's not going to be a fast process, but a lot of it does depend on making sure that the world is looking at this as a shared responsibility that we all need to participate in.
Well, just to bring the conversation back here to Los Angeles, El Salvador is a huge, Guatemala is a country with, a sort of narco-democracy, but El Salvador is a pretty lawless country run by gangs, many of whom originate out of Los Angeles, and they're forcing these kids north. So is there anything that can be done to solve the problems in these countries? Or it just seems to be sort of counterintuitive to try and, put a Band-Aid on the to stop the bleeding rather than, put on a tourniquet.
Right. Well, think of it this way. In El Salvador, gangs form because people feel like they need alternatives or ways to empower themselves to the situation that they're in. So if there was assistance in El Salvador, for example, to help with people, children getting education, people finding jobs, sort of the whole gamut of development activities, presumably, eventually, slowly, the need to have gangs to wield power and to get things done would reduce, and then fewer people might be fleeing. So, I mean, it's a bit different for every country, of course, and it's not necessarily a given that that funding and development are going to solve every problem, but they do address a lot of the base issues that cause the drivers of displacement to arise, like gang violence, for example.
Well, Dawa Grisgrabe, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dawa Grisgrabe, who leads Refugees International's research and advocacy related to the Middle East and North Africa, focusing mainly on the Syrian displacement crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts and contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.